Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The contradictions in the United States nuclear weapons policy is the subject of this edition of Radio Curious. Our guest is Dr. Siam Brown, who during the past 55 years has taught at major universities, been a special advisor to the Department of Defense and the Department of State, and has written 12 books on United States foreign policy and international relations. His current work is the study of and writing about the contradictions in the United States nuclear weapons policy. When he and I visited in the studios of Radio Curious on July 4th, 2014, I asked him to explain and discuss these contradictions.
That contradiction is between the promise and commitment to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. national security policy and to work toward a world free of nuclear weapons. The contradiction between that and the reality of nuclear planning, of strategic planning in the U.S. government, which features a modernization of the U.S. nuclear arsenal, and a doctrine of what's called extended deterrence, and that is that we will respond with nuclear weapons to any attack against allies or partners by a nuclear-armed country. Well, I think this contradiction is bad for the United States and bad for the world. It commits the United States to engage in the slaughter of innocent people, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of innocent people, in response to a terrible attack. And the justification for that commitment is that that threat to respond in a devastating way to a devastating attack will prevent that attack from occurring. It will deter the use of nuclear weapons by any adversary. That's the logic behind it. But the logic is fundamentally flawed.
What are the flaws?
The flaw is basically the flaw of credibility. It is an incredible threat that the United States, at a moment of truth, will not want to deliver. Ever since Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that threat has been part of U.S. policy. But fortunately, it has never been unleashed. That is, the capacity to kill as many people, as many innocent people as were killed in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And other countries, adversaries, as well as our allies, know that in a moment of truth, a U.S. president is not going to order the incineration of hundreds of thousands or possibly even millions of people in an aggressor country. Even if it were, let's say, an attack by the North Koreans against South Korea, in which nuclear weapons are used against Seoul, Obama is not going to order a nuclear attack on Pyongyang. So it's an incredible threat. As an incredible threat, it loses its deterrence capability. And to the extent that it loses its deterrence capability, it provides an excuse for other countries to arm themselves with nuclear weapons. We claim to be against the spread of nuclear weapons, so that the threat to respond in a nuclear way to a nuclear attack or an attack by other kinds of weapons of mass destruction has somewhat more credibility if they themselves, as possible victims, are doing it. Now, even if the United States itself were struck by weapons of mass destruction, it's doubtful that the U.S. president is going to order a eye for an eye response, that is, to destroy, let's say, Beijing, in case we get into an exchange with China over Taiwan, in which the Chinese decide that in order to equalize the deterrence situation, they will attack San Francisco or Los Angeles with nuclear weapons. Even in that circumstance, It's doubtful that a United States president is going to order the incineration of Beijing. So its function as a deterrent is full of holes.
What in the United States foreign policy now in 2014 maintains this contradiction?
A number of things do. One is that by threatening to use nuclear weapons in case of a nuclear attack, we can assure our allies or friends that we will protect them in the most extreme circumstances, and therefore they don't have to develop nuclear weapons of their own. Part of the objective of this is to discourage the spread of nuclear weapons. Another is to scare potential adversaries from getting into any kind of a war against the United States because we have that capability. Now, there's a reliance on this capability after a half century of not using nuclear weapons, even when we've been at war. When we were at war with North Korea and China didn't have nuclear weapons, we didn't use nuclear weapons against China. In other circumstances, where the United States was at war, like Vietnam, we didn't use nuclear weapons. We used all kinds of dirty weapons, but we didn't use nuclear weapons. So the world has seen that this threat is rather hollow. The threat itself not only is hollow, but it is an immoral threat. To threaten to incinerate hundreds of thousands of people, or millions of people, women, children, elderly people, people in hospitals, whatever, and not necessarily the people in their armed forces, though you'd go against them also. To threaten to do that is to threaten to do something that is immoral. And everybody recognizes that, that it is immoral. And yet, we maintain this posture. And we are supposed to be the leaders of the world in combating terrorism. And terrorism is the indiscriminate attack against innocent people.
What are the forces or the policies within the United States government now mm-hmm. that maintain this posture of contradiction?
Mm-hmm. Two things. One is more benign, that is inertia. This has been our stated policy. To back off from that stated policy will subject a president to all kinds of attacks from the hawks, so to speak. I mean, Obama has said he is for denuclearizing U.S. foreign policy and national security policy, but he's been unwilling to embrace even a no first use of nuclear weapons policy, let alone a no use of nuclear weapons policy. So part of it is inertia. Another is the infatuation with this paradigm of deterrence, that the only way to deter terrible things that you don't like is to threaten the aggressor with totally unacceptable damage. And nuclear weapons provide that kind of a threat. So it exists at the level of threat, of what's called declaratory policy, of rhetoric, at the same time that everybody who is aware of what's going on, it doesn't necessarily mean the general public, knows that the emperor has no clothes. The NATO countries doubt that we will come to their defense with a nuclear attack, that we will implement Article 5 of the NATO treaty that says an attack against any one of us is an attack against all, okay? That we won't implement that with using nuclear weapons. They know that. And yet in our stated nuclear strategy, open to the public, we say we will. So part of it's inertia, but part of it is the notion that we will look weak if we go back on our word to them and to our adversaries. If we don't have something else to do that is credible, that can deter potential aggressors from ever attempting to use their weapons of mass destruction.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Dr. C.M. Brown, the author of Faces of Power, a new edition of which will be published in early 2015. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. C.M. Brown, what do we do? What is your answer to this contradiction?
Well, what we should do has now become more possible because of technological advances that allow for non-nuclear capabilities to destroy very effectively an adversary's armed forces, to reduce them, if they regard themselves as some kind of a military power, to being a fifth or sixth or tenth rate nuclear power. We now have the technologies that, if they were sufficiently invested in, could deter by credibly threatening to disarm another country forcibly.
And what are those technologies?
Well, these are technologies that make for accurate, swift, long-range, what the strategists call kinetic attacks, that is, destructive activity, to be inflicted not with nuclear-armed missiles, but with what are called conventionally armed missiles, non-nuclear-armed missiles, and non-nuclear-armed bombs. Our force posture still has nuclear-armed missiles in it, okay, and nuclear bombs that are carried by aircraft and cruise missiles and so on. We are still armed that way, the nuclear arsenal. But if we were to disarm ourselves of that nuclear arsenal, and if we invested rapidly enough and sufficiently enough in alternative capabilities, which are I call non-nuclear, the conventional term is conventional weapons, but there are other kinds of weapons besides conventional weapons that could help, such as cyber weapons, we could disable another side's war-making capability without killing hundreds of thousands or millions of people at the same time, which nuclear weapons would do. And therefore, a response to aggression, a threatened response to aggression, which relies on advanced non-nuclear capabilities, is more credible as a deterrent. We have the capability to move away from it. But moving away from it is inhibited by those two factors, inertia, as well as the fear that the administration will look weak in the face of its critics.
What you said earlier is that there would be criticism by the hawks of any president who would propose that.
Yes.
Would not the hawks suffer the same problems as the rest of us?
Yes, they would, if they were in power. And what's interesting is one of the most hawkish presidents of recent years, who would you say? Ronald Reagan, right? Well, Ronald Reagan, a number of years into his presidency, said, we're depending upon an immoral strategy in which we and the Soviets are holding each other hostage. There's a better way, and that is we ought to develop defenses against nuclear weapons rather than relying upon a retaliatory delivery of a nuclear threat. So he was searching for something. That particular technology is insufficient. That is, missile defenses. It was shown to be insufficient. We still have a missile defense program, and we are deploying missile defenses against attacks by North Korea or potentially Iran. But we have no adequate missile defense if the Russians should ever use their weapons against us, or if the Chinese should ever use their weapons against us. But even Reagan didn't like being trapped in that situation. Secretly, all of the presidents since Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Carter, George H.W. Bush, Clinton, and George W. Bush have said they don't want to have what's called the football. The football is the briefcase that they have with them all the time that has the nuclear response buttons in it. They don't want to respond in nuclear ways, and they said they don't. And they've been asking the Defense Department to give them other options. because they know that in a moment of truth, they won't want to have that as their only option. They want other options. They, you know, Nixon was a hawk, and certainly George W. Bush was a hawk. And yet, the Pentagon and the military establishment and the hawks that support them in Congress have not been willing to renounce strategies of mass destruction.
Why are they not willing to renounce those strategies?
Their argument is that if we renounce those strategies and others don't, then the others could hold us hostage and we can't hold them hostage in return. That others, like the Chinese, like the North Koreans, like the Iranians, like other countries, if the Saudis get the bomb and so on, are not constrained by this moral inhibition of attacking and destroying civilian populations. So they would have that advantage over us. This is the argument
but
against it.
Isn't what you say about the accurate and swift long-range kinetic attacks still available to interfere with their potential use of nuclear attacks?
It is, and it might not stop them. In other words, in order to stop them, you might have to preempt them if it looked like they were going to attack you. And you might not be able to destroy all of their weapons, all of their nuclear weapons. So you could face a situation in which the United States was attacked in an immoral way, where our cities were attacked, and we would not retaliate against them. Now, this is a difficult relationship to sell to the American people and to their representative in Congress. Do we want to be in a position in which an adversary could destroy New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco and Chicago and so on, and we can't destroy them that way? Okay. Now, what I'm arguing is that it's not very credible that we would respond that way even if we were attacked with nuclear weapons. It is credible for us in response to punish them by disarming them of their military capability that they have left. So this terrible situation that people can imagine interferes with a lot of people thinking seriously about the strategy. It's hard to get them over that hump of being worried that others could be willing to attack us in that devastating way, and we would not be willing to attack them in that devastating way in response.
So facing the difficulty of it being hard to get them over this hump, mm-hmm. what do you propose?
Well, I propose that this be discussed more openly, like I am now discussing it with you. And I've written some articles already. One article was published in Survival magazine, which is the leading British magazine on strategy, raising this possibility. And I am involved in seeking support from various foundations to carry on a dialogue internationally with think tank types in countries around the world to at least get the unofficial community to start batting around these issues, to be able to create a willingness to discard the prevailing paradigm and adopt a new paradigm. It takes different kind of thinking to do that.
And the thinking needs to occur in Washington and other centers of power.
Yes.
Where it's not being received.
That's right. And my argument, and it's part of the argument that's the hardest to take, we've discussed a little bit, is that even if others aren't willing to go along with us, other countries are not willing to go along with us. The Russians may not want to go along with us. The Chinese may not want to go along with us. And they're our main worry because they have substantial nuclear capabilities that could hit the United States. Even if they are not, we should do so unilaterally because it's in our interest to do so. It's in our interest to have a more credible response to the terrible things that they might someday think of inflicting upon us.
And that response is the swift kinetic attacks.
Yes, swift and accurate and powerful.
From your perspective, what's going on in the minds of the people in power in the United States that do not want to address these issues?
Well, again, I have to return to the notion of inertia. In other words, it's very difficult to change basic strategy in such a fundamental way. This country and its intellectuals went through years of rethinking war in the nuclear age. And they developed this larger paradigm of nuclear deterrence and defense, spurred on by people like Winston Churchill, who argued that the balance of terror may have a sturdy child, that is, of security, where both sides are afraid to go to war against each other because of this balance of terror. And this became the operating strategic philosophy in both the United States and the Soviet Union, in which, in our arms control negotiations with the Soviet Union and so on, we have developed, and they have accepted, a relationship of what's called mutual assured destruction. And that is that neither side will attack the other side if the other side, after the biggest attack that the first striker can render, will have enough destructive power left to destroy the attacker. And we both have to be able to assure each other that no matter how large the other side's attack, that the surviving forces on our side can still inflict that level of damage. Then we will not go to war against each other. What's the abbreviation for mutual assured destruction? MAD, mutual assured destruction. And in fact, statespersons all over the world use that term to describe the existing nuclear deterrent paradigm. It's MAD. Okay. And one of the most devastating realizations to me working in this field was that the no nuclear community who were demonstrating against U.S. nuclear strategies embraced MAD as the philosophy. The Society for a Sane Nuclear Policy, which was called SANE, embraced MAD as the best way to avoid war. Okay. It was a devastating realization. But we were all crazy during the Cold War. Now we're out of the Cold War. Do we need to perpetuate that crazy relationship?
From your perspective and working in the arena of these issues for over 50 years in Washington, what can the average person do to heighten the contradiction and bring it to the forefront?
I've had to go step by step through the logic and develop the case very carefully before publishing, and I did publish an article last year, as I said, in Survival, and also now asking for grant money so that I can conduct seminars in Washington, but also in Tokyo and in Singapore and at NATO headquarters in Brussels with strategists to get them in the room and have them address this set of issues and deal with what I'm proposing as the alternative. There is a parallel movement going on the part of ban the bomb type people. And they are asking for a treaty, a worldwide treaty, to ban nuclear weapons. Now, that's an objective that could possibly be realized sometime in the future. Obama has said that's what he's for, but he probably won't see that realized in his lifetime. He said that specifically at Prague when he announced he was for a world without nuclear weapons. Why? Because many other countries won't go along with it. They are relying on nuclear weapons for their prestige, for whatever, for deterring their enemies. They won't go along with it. So we're not going to get that kind of a treaty. We're not going to get it through the Security Council. It now takes a leap into an unknown and a different paradigm, as I mentioned, to say, even though we can't get that treaty, we can renounce the use of nuclear weapons. And it will enhance our security and perhaps existentially provide a model for others to begin thinking that way.
Well, Dr. C.M. Brown, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious and ask a few questions about you. an aha or eureka moment in your life's experience that you live by now?
It happened in August 1945. I was still a high school student at that time, a freshman high school student, when I heard of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I said to myself, never again should this happen. And I decided that I would do whatever I could for it not to happen. But I got caught up in music, and the world seemed to be at basic peace after 1945. I thought, well, this is a kind of an abstract thing. But then the Korean War broke out in the summer of 1950, and I realized that it wasn't an abstract thing, that war, big war, was possible, and we could stumble into a nuclear war. And that's when I decided I would not be a professional musician through the rest of my life, but would work on these issues.
I know from other sources that you're a man of many skills and talents and experience, and I would like to know what you would like to do with the remainder of your one precious mm-hmm. life now at the age of 81.
What I would like to do most is to generate a very serious discussion of this alternative grand strategy on the part of people with power. That's what I would like to do most.
C.M. Brown, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
Yes, definitely. There is a book by Ward Wilson, who is now at the Princeton Center for Advanced Studies, called Five Nuclear Myths, in which Wilson takes apart the standard notion that the reason that the Cold War didn't develop into a hot war was because both sides had nuclear weapons. He doesn't go as far as I've gone with respect to, okay, so what do we do about the fact that we've been living under a mythology of mutual nuclear deterrence?
Dr. C.M. Brown, thank you for being with us on Radio Curious.
I'm pleased to have the opportunity to discuss these issues with you.
For the past 55 years, Dr. C.M. Brown has been a policy advisor, professor, and author of 12 books on United States foreign policies and international relations. The book he recommends is Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons by Ward Wilson. The article to which he referred in our visit, Beyond Mad, Obama's Risky But Realistic Effort to Reduce the Role of Nuclear Weapons, is found in the December 2013 issue of Survival Magazine. The link to this magazine is on the Radio Curious website. You may also hear two 1995 Radio Curious interviews with Dr. C.M. Brown on our website. For full disclosure, I'm proud to say that C.M. Brown is my uncle. This program was recorded on July 4th, 2014. There are over 500 archive editions of Radio Curious on our website, www.radiocurious.org, where they're free for you to stream, download, enjoy, and share. We appreciate your curiosity, ideas, comments, and questions. You may reach us by email, curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is our associate producer, and I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.